We're on Daf Lamed Tes Amud Beis. Now, we had a Mishnah. We're still in that Mishnah about the differences between Ones and Mufateh. And the basic subject of yesterday's Shia was Tzar, and how to understand why it is that in the case of Ones there's Tzar, what is that Tzar, and in the case of Mufateh there's no Tzar as far as Chiyuv Tashlumei Chavol. Then we went on to a different discussion, and that was a discussion here about Mufateh. When exactly does he pay the Knas? And the Mishnah uses a very strange term and identifies the moment of Chiyuv Knas as Lichshe Yotzi. The Gemara had a problem with this because he hasn't even married her yet, and the Mishnah is talking about divorcing her. And furthermore, why would he have to pay the Knas after he divorces her? Maybe he'd have to pay the Ksuba, but not the Knas. The subject of our Mishnah is Knas, the difference between Ones, who pays immediately, and Mufateh, who pays at some delay or when some condition is fulfilled, has nothing to do with the fact that the Mufateh has to pay the Ksuba if he divorces his wife. So therefore, Amar Abaye, the last thing that we learned yesterday, and we'll look at it inside in a minute, I'll tell you where it is that you take the word Lichshayotzi out of its literal context, and instead, Lichshalo Yichnos. It doesn't mean that when he divorces her, but rather when he decides that he's not marrying her, meaning that the Mufateh has two options. He could decide he's not marrying her, and he could pay the Knas immediately, or he could decide to marry her. And if he does decide to marry her, then he doesn't pay the Knas. Now, the fact that the Gemara assumes without question that if the Mufateh marries her, he doesn't pay Knas, that's based on a Gemara later on that's going to derive this from the Pasuk that says, "In ma'ein, yima'ein, etc., then kesev yishkol kemor habsulos," meaning if the marriage is not consummated, and we'll soon see under what circumstances the marriage will not be consummated, then he pays Knas. The Chiyuv Knas is conditional on the fact that there is no marriage, or if we want to say it in a more positive sense, if there is a marriage, there's no Knas. So we're up to Tanya Nami Hachi today, and let's see if we can find that. It is...
Well, it's one line after two dots.
Oh, great. So if you find the two dots, then you drop a little bit below that, and it's Tanya Nami Hachi. The first word in the line is Nami, and it's about halfway through the Amud. Now, this price is going to support the fact that Abaye reinterprets the mission of Lichshayotzi, because the price is not even going to have the word Lichshayotzi. It's going to really have the words that Abaye used, Lichshay Lo Yichnos. Tanya Nami Hochi, Afal Pisha Omru HaMafata Nosen, meaning Nosen is Haknas, that's Tafka when Lichshay Lo Yichnos, if he opts not to marry her, meaning that if he marries her, he does not pay Knas. Nevertheless, Boshes Upagam Nosein Miyad, meaning Boshes Upagam as Chiyuvik Havola, compensation for her loss, has to be paid regardless, irrespective of whether he marries or he doesn't marry her. Whereas Ones and Knas, I'm sorry, the Knas of Mufateh is dependent upon whether he marries her, and he'll pay the Knas if and when he decides not to marry her. We'll give him that choice. He decides, "I'm not marrying her." He pays the Knas. If, on the other hand, he decides to marry her, he doesn't have to pay the Knas. Not so in the case of Boshes Upagam. Boshes Upagam are not written in this parasha of Mufateh. Boshes Upagam are written in the parasha of Chavola, and it happens to be an overlap of two different parashas, two different mechayiv. And there's one mechayiv that's called Mufateh, and that's, you know, the chamishim kesef that he has to pay as a knas. And then there's another mechayiv which has nothing to do with knas at all. That's simply the result of the physical damage that she suffered. And in this case, we have Boshes Upagam. Now, again, you can ask the following question, which is a very relevant one. Why does he have to pay Boshes Upagam if she if she offered herself and consented to have this Maisim Bia, how could a woman consent and then turn around and sue him for damages? And the answer is because of the father, meaning that she's a Nara, and she doesn't have, we discussed this yesterday, the rights to be mochel on the schusim, on the monetary rights of the father. She cannot undermine the father's rights here. So she may say, I don't care about this maisa with all the boshes and the pagam that I suffer from and loss and so on and so on. But she's in the rishus of her father. But he's in the driver's
seat. I understand that regarding boshe. Regarding pagam, the pagam was that she becomes less marriageable, but she's getting married. So what loss is there to the father in that case?
Well, keep in mind that the father could set up any conditions that he wants. For example, let's talk about the Kesef Kiddushin.
Okay.
The Mefata is going to have to pay Kesef Kiddushin, and that money accrues to the father. How much is he going to give for Kesef Kiddushin? Well, the father's right to say, I want such and such. This is the going rate for a basula. Well, what? Guess what? Says the Mefata. She's not a basula. I can testify to that. And therefore, I don't want to pay. I don't want to pay that high stipend for a kesef kiddushin. Well, the Mefata says, well, she agreed to this maisa. Well, why are you turning around now and billing me and causing me a hefsed? Well, the answer is that she had no right, says the father, to submit herself willingly for this maisa that's making her into pagam. Let me give you another answer to your question.
Okay.
And that's the parasha of Amma Ivriya.
Of what?
Amma Ivriya.
Okay.
And the father has rights to sell her as an Amma Ivriya. Now, in the father's decision process over here, meaning the Mefat himself, let's say, offers to marry her, the father has a right to say, wait a minute, I don't want to give her off to marriage. I want to sell her as an omivria. And if he goes with that option, then we certainly understand pagam, because her value to be sold on the market as an omivria has decreased. But I think all the different variations and scenarios really come down to one principle, and that is that she doesn't have rights of mechila. So if there's a pagam, and again, you're asking exactly how we evaluate the pagam in a situation where anyway there's a marriage partner, but the question is again, how much is he willing to pay for this marriage in the case of Mefata? So let me just read to you a footnote. He says here that boshes upagam are Enom Ksuvim Parshas Onu Mefata El Parshas Chovel the Enom Tluyim B'chiv Shalo La'Sesa La'Isha and therefore V'tzorach La'Sesa La'Alter. Okay.
Dorach La'Sesa?
La'Teta, to give it to her, La'Alter. In fact, he gives it to the Av. Now, there's one thing that you pointed out, Chaim, that is absolutely correct, halacha lemaisa, and that is what happens in a case where the father dies. So let's say, for argument's sake, she's a yesoma. So a yesoma mafuta could sue for boshes supagam based on the fact that she doesn't have a father and she's in her own monetary domain. She's independent of her father. He's gone. But in this case of Mefata, I doubt if she would be able to collect boshes upagam. And here I wouldn't even differentiate between the two of them. You were focused on pagam. Let's throw in boshes into the equation. And I think you're 100% right. That as soon as we neutralize the father, if he's out of the picture, then she consented to have this action, and therefore she can't turn around and say, I want to collect boshes upagam as nizke chavola. But again, I think our discussion is limited to a case where the father is very much alive and well and in the picture, and he has the right to say that she doesn't. She's not the Baal HaBos on her dini mamonos, and she cannot be mocheles. But it's interesting to me that if we ever want to find a clear-cut distinction between knas on the one hand and boshes upagam on the other hand, conceptually, they're two different types of chiyuvim. One is a penalty, more of a punishment, and the other is compensation, is tashlumin azikin. But if we ever want to find a practical, you know, sink your teeth into cut ice distinction between the two, an afkamina lemaisa, it's right here in front of our eyes. That in the case of knas, there may be all sorts of conditions as to whether or not the mafata pays the knas. For example, if he marries her, if he opts to marry her, and she agrees, etc., etc., then he alleviates himself from the payment of knas. Not so in the case of boshes ubagam. You know, here, just as a footnote, this is really not our sugya at all, but I just want to point out that if the mafata is paying boshes ubagam, and then he's marrying her, you might ask the question, we have a principle, konsa isha, konsa baila. So in a sense, he's like taking it from one hand and he's putting it in another hand.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean when he deposits the boshes ubagam into her bank account? After all, he now is marrying her and he controls her bank account. But the answer is that we make a big mistake if we think that a man gets married and he owns all of his wife's possessions. Mm. Then that's not a fair or accurate description of the Torah law. A woman has her own yad and her own ownership, and that's called nixei malug. I mean, there's something called nixei tzombazo, which is a lot more confusing and complex, but nixei malug means that whatever possessions she owns. And for example, Yerusha, let's say her father dies and she inherits her father. That money, even within the marriage, is her money. The ksuv establishes, in the case of Nixei Malug, which is again classic, you know, the exception to the rules, Nixei Tzobarza, but Nixei Malug, that the husband can collect the peros means the interest or the dividends that come from her nechasim. So if she owns an apartment, he can rent out the apartment and collect the rental money. But the apartment remains hers. So if the apartment is worth $100,000 and rental is $1,000, let's not think that he, meaning the husband, is now the owner of her possessions. Not at all. What he has rights to is peros. But the goof is the etzem keren belongs to her. And therefore, when he pays her boshes ubagam in this case of mafata, which the Gemara now points out is irrelevant to the fact that he's marrying her, that boshes ubagam goes into her bank account, and it's her money. It's not his. No, that's just a footnote on the side. Yeah. I mean, that's not really our sugya. Okay, now our sugya now, which is going to pretty much take us till the Mishnah, is the question of who has veto power in terms of marriage, both in the case of onus and in the case of mafata. And the sugya that we're about to learn is quite challenging, just on a mathematical level. There's going to be Abaye's approach and Rava's approach, and the Gemara is going to ask why Abaye didn't accept Rava, why Rava didn't accept Abaye. The Brisa says the following: Echad ha'ones ve'echad ha'mafata bein hiu bein avio yecholim li'akev. Now let's understand what's going on. As a result of ones or mafata, there's a marriage relationship that's pending. You know, that's possible and maybe even likely. You know, then it hasn't happened yet, the marriage, because again, even if he was mafata for the purpose of convincing her to marry him, but that's not kedusha bia, and that doesn't generate issues. That has to be done with an explicit areya mekudeshesly in front of two edim and so forth and so on. So the marriage hasn't yet taken place yet. And now we're asking, will it take place? Well, whose agreement do we have to have? Now, as soon as you ask me this question, I would say we certainly have to have his agreement, because there's no such thing as forcing a person to marry a woman. You need das mekadesh.
Even though I was always in the impression the onus.
Excellent. That's exactly the next point I was going to make. But you should know that even in, let's say, the case of Yibum, where the Torah imposes an obligation on him to marry her, and maybe you'd find other situations in which there would be a mitzvah to marry a girl, a specific girl, nevertheless we would not be able to force him against his will to marry her. After Erusin, there is a possibility that we could force him into Nisuin, because Nisuin doesn't really require das. But as far as Erusin is concerned, meaning Ishus and Kedushin, you need his das. But the answer is that in the case of Ones, we're going to force him to marry her. Now again, you have to ask the question exactly what that means. How can we force him to marry her, beat him until he's blue, black and blue all over, but you still need das kedushin? And here I'm tempted to think that we should activate the principle called Makin osat shiyoma rotsani. That maybe at the end of the day, you know, they'll make him an offer and he can't refuse. You know what I mean? And he'll agree, but he has to have some sort of an agreement. But in any event, the veto power to basically reject the marriage as a concept, that this marriage is not going to take place, that's not in his hands. And that's why the Braisa here, since it includes ones, limits it to two veto powers. And that's her veto power and the father's veto power. The Braisa doesn't mention a word about the Baal himself. And that's going to come up in the case of Mufata, but not in the case of Ones. And since the Braisa is combining the two and showing the common denominator between the two, hence it leaves out the Baal. So who are the Balabatim, so to speak, who have the veto powers? And the Braisa establishes that both in the case of Ones and in the case of Mufata, both the father and her, and she, the Nara, have veto power. Now, not everything here is so clear and so smooth. I'll tell you why. In the case of Mafata, I really can begin to appreciate the father's position. Because after all, the marriage in the case of Mafata is optional. There's no mitzvah of marriage here. The Torah has not made any statement that it's the will of God that this pitui should lead and culminate to a marriage. We don't find any indication that that's the will of the Almighty. And therefore, I can begin to understand that since marriage is in the hands of the father when she's a Nara, he's the Baal Habos over her marriage, that she should have the right to veto the marriage. In the case of Ones, however, logically, again, we're going to see the Gemara in a minute, but logically, it's not so simple that the father should have veto power. Here in the Torah, God has expressed his will that he with a capital H, wants this marriage to take place.
Velo ti
Elisha.
Now, in the Mafater, please remind me what exactly means when it says, Mohor yam harena lo liisha.
Okay, we're going to get to that in a few minutes.
Fine, okay.
Let's just go slowly here. But I just want to make one point. If you ask me why she has veto power, that I understand. After all, she's going to have to live with this guy for the rest of her life. He raped her. It would be very unfair, I think, on an ethical level, to impose this marriage upon her. But once she's given her okay, her agreement, and again, as far as the Ma'anis himself is concerned, we're not even going to ask him because we're going to beat him till he's blue all over, right? Black and blue. When the father's position comes into play, it's a little bit confusing because I don't understand how the father could, in a sense, clash with the Torah. The Torah's will seems to be that this marriage takes place below Sila Isha, unless we add another element to the equation. The Torah says that this, in a sense, is going to placate the father. In other words, the father's all nervous. You know, he has to marry off his daughter, and now she was raped. A terrible situation occurred. So the Torah says, you know what? I'm going to give you, Mr. So-and-so, the father of this girl, an option of a low Elisha, meaning that if you want to have some sort of a compensation, not a monetary compensation, but a compensation of the fact that your ability to marry off your daughter has been robbed from you to some extent, we're going to give you an option that if you give us the okay, again, assuming that she agrees as well, we're going to beat this guy to a pulp and force the marriage. That might be a whole nother perspective here on what it means, bein hi ubein avia yechol makir. That even though the Torah says below Sila Isha, the father could say, I don't want it. What do you mean you don't want it? The Torah wants it. No, the Torah doesn't want it. The Torah has no vested interest in having a marriage between a Ma'anes and an Anusa. The Torah wants to make sure that the father is placated with at least one option, that, you know, if he's looking out at the market and it's very dismal, who's going to want to marry this girl who's raped? Never. That's not my first choice. Today, again, we live in a very liberal society, but back in the day, so the Torah gives the father the option of having this marriage take place and even to force the husband to marry her. But that's only an option. So therefore, what the Gemara is assuming in this price is that the father is not clashing against the will of the Torah. Why does he have a right to do so? I understand her position. She doesn't want to live with this, this love, if you find the expression. Now here, we have a machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos. So Rashi, Dibra Maskil Yecholim, we'll take a look at this Rashi. Just 1 second, I want to just...
It's a short Rashi.
It's about halfway down the page. Yecholim li'akev shelo yachnisena. Which means exactly what we said until now. That's, this is before we see Tosfos Dibra Maskil Ein. And Rashi's saying that the father has a veto power as far as lachnisa, meaning to marry. Again, we're assuming that she's a ketana or a nara. Again, a ketana, remember, is machlokes from Bimei and Chachomim, but let's go according to Chachomim, a ketana or a nara. And basically, it makes sense in the following way. The father could marry her off in any event. Right? That's called koach ha'av, lahasiyas bito, afil bal korcha. And the Torah here is mechadesh that she has a right to say, in this case of onus, I don't want to marry him. I say this because Tosfos is going to get very nervous about this. We have a paradoxical situation which doesn't seem to bother Rashi, but will bother Tosfos. And the paradox is in the fact that if not for this onus situation, in a normal case, the father has absolute rights to marry off his daughter as a ketana or a nara, even against her will. And all of a sudden, what Rashi is interpreting here is that she has veto power, and she can say and determine that she doesn't want to marry this fellow. Why is that so? Meaning, there's veto power, either her veto power or his veto power, meaning the father. We have already the father's haskama. He said yes, she's a nara. She says, I don't want to marry him. Well, wait a second. The father can marry her off to anybody, whether she likes it or not. And Rashi says here, in this case of Ones, she has an independent veto power. And Tosfos Dibra Maskil Ein, which is a long Tosfos, I'm just going to read the summary of Tosfos here in the Masifti. He's very good at giving you a highlights of the Tosfos. He says, no. Ein kavonas ha-gemara shehi yecholu li'akev oso milakomtsa. It can't be. When Rashi says yecholim li'akev shelo yachnisena, Rashi can't be taken literally, or if he is, he's not correct. Why? Because she doesn't have the ability to prevent her father from marrying off to anyone he decides that he wants to marry her off to, even against her will. So how can it be that in this case of Ones, if the father wants to marry her off to any shlub on the face of the earth, he can do so against her will, despite her yelling and screaming and veto. But here, in the case of Ones, she has all of a sudden she has the right to veto. Which again, I think Rashi's looking at it from a more ethical perspective. How can you force her to be married to this guy? Tosfos looking at it from a more cold, calculated, halachic, legal perspective. And legally, he's in charge of our marriage, so what kind of veto power could she have? But based on Tosfos's premise, he reinterprets his Gemara, and he will not accept Rashi's interpretation of Yecholim Liakim Milakomsa. El HaKavona Shebiyad HaNaro Lemayim Le'inyin Sheyischayev L'shalim Es HaKnas Afim Komsa. In other words, according to Tosfos, what's going on here in the Yecholim Liakev is that in the case of Mafata, she has the right to say, I want to collect knas. Meaning her decision that she doesn't want to marry him is relevant to the payment of knas. Again, in the case of onus, it's irrelevant because the onus always pays knas. But in the case of Mafata, we establish that he has the option, he has the alternative, if he so wishes, to marry her and exempt himself from paying the knas. That's not so in the case where she puts her foot down and she says, I don't want to marry this guy. Now, it's true that the father could marry her off against her will, even though, despite her veto, but nevertheless, she has the right to demand the knas. So it's interesting. The knas itself, in a certain sense, is her right. And And she can exercise that right and demand the knas by saying, I don't want the alternative. And in that context, the father is out of the picture. In other words, she has a certain element of bias over the knas to determine through her veto power that he, the father, will pay this knas regardless of the fact that he's going to marry her. Meaning even if the father does give his haskama and marry her off. Ubelow miyana, if she had not objected and vetoed this marriage, then mefata would not pay the knas if the father agrees, and the mefata himself, to marry her. So the option to replace knas with marriage, which you and I would have said exists if the father gives his haskama and the mefata wants to marry her, is not so. We're not going to allow the knas to be replaced by or pushed off by marriage in a case where she is mama'enis, meaning that she vetoes the power. Again, there's a lot more in this Tosfos here than what we're going to do today, but that's...
Wait, that's Tosfos.
This is so different than Rashi. It's radically...
She can demand the knas, and therefore he has to pay. But the moment he pays, he no longer has to marry her.
Well, no, we're talking about mefata now. Mefata from day one, he doesn't have to marry her. Nobody can force him to marry her.
No, but
if he marries her, he exempts himself from the knas. But now we're saying the following. You and I would have said, well, if he wants to marry her, and the father agrees to marry her, because he's the malabos on marrying her,
right?
Then that's the end of the story. At this point, he marries her, he doesn't pay knas. According to Tosfos, the chiddush of this braisa that says, bein hiu, bein avia, the bein hi in the case of mefat is only relevant to the knas. She has no way, no how, a power to object to the marriage because the father's given his agreement and that's it, that's final. But what she can do is, and that's what the braisa means by bein hi, she can say, I want the knas because I don't want to marry you. In other words, we're differentiating here between the marriage itself and the knas. In dine marriage, she has no say. Whether she'll marry this guy, we're not going to hear a peep from her. It's irrelevant. She can scream until she's blue in the face. It's like any case where the father wants to marry her off, bal kor. But now we're going through dine knas, and Tos says that's where she has a veto power. Her veto power is only significant in the fact that she can rob the mefate of his either-or option, meaning either I marry you and I don't pay knas, or I don't marry you and I pay knas. No, you don't have that option. You have an absolute, unconditional chiv to pay the knas. In that sense, when she vetoes it, onus and mefata are really the same. Because just like we said in the case of onus, that he pays the knas miyad, meaning it's unconditional,
right.
So too in the case of mefata, which we said is a conditional chiv knas, and if he marries her, he opts for marrying her, he doesn't pay knas. That's not true. Why? Because she was mevayenis. So once she presses the veto button, it says, no, I don't want to marry this guy, then at that point, mefata becomes like onus. Yishalim is a knas miyad. Okay. Again, there's a lot more here than what we're doing. I mean, we're not even touching the surface of the sugya, but the main point that I want to convey to you is that in Tosfos's frame of reference, knas, in the case of mefata, has its own rules and regulations. It doesn't beat to the same tune as the marriage issue. So we can talk from now till doomsday about who's going to decide if she marries him and who's not going to decide, whose consent we need, who has veto power. That's all a discussion about the marriage. But if you want to talk about the knas, she's very much in the driver's seat. In what sense? Because she can tell him, look, fellow, even if this marriage is going to be consummated, because you and my father got together as a cartel, you know, you got together as a monopoly, and you decided I'm going to marry you, you're going to have to pay the knas. Don't think that by marrying me... Now, in a certain sense, she has a little bit of what's the word when you talk about weight? A word that starts with an L. Anyway, she now has a certain influence over him. Why?
Leverage.
Leverage. Oh, thank you. Leverage. She has a certain leverage here. Again, even though the marriage will take place against her will, in a certain sense, she can make it less attractive for him to marry.
Yeah.
Because one of the reasons he's marrying her is to exempt himself from the knas. The knas is a very heavy penalty, and it's very serious. And it could be that that's why the Torah set up this knas, because the Torah really wants to encourage him to marry her. The Torah's putting out a carrot for him, mm-hmm. and saying, you know, you did this with her, and now she's already defiled, so to speak, and you know what? you go ahead and marry. The Torah's not going to go as far as to force him, but the Torah's going to make it worth his while and give him a good offer. She now could influence him not to marry her, because if the allurement and the attraction of marrying her was to save himself the knas, she says, I tell you what, you can marry me, but you'll pay the knas. And that control she has. Again, there's a lot more that has to be studied here, but I'm just mentioning this, and that's radically different than Rashi. Rashi says that although, as a general rule, the father has absolute, unconditional rights to marry her off because she's a katana and nara, there's one exception to the rule, and that's the case of Mafata. The father could scream from now until doomsday, I want this marriage to take place. According to Rashi, she has veto power. This little 12-year-old girl, or if she's a katana, who knows how old she is, right? She's 3 years old, and she can say, I don't want to marry this guy. And again, on an ethical level, I dig this Rashi. I don't know, today they don't use those terms anymore, but when I was a kid, they used to say, if you like something, you dig it. You remember that?
Yeah.
So and again, if you say it to this generation, they probably have no clue. They think you're digging a grave, or so they don't know what you're digging. So the Gemara now analyzes this price. Bishleim of Mefuta. I can understand in the case of Mefuta why both the father and the daughter have veto rights. Ksiv, it says in the pasuk, Imma'ein, Yimma'ein, Avia. And the double language is very strange. Why does the Torah have to say Ma'ein, Yimma'ein? There must be some extra ribui here. Eli Ella Avia, I know that, and that's explicit in the Torah, that the father could block and veto this marriage, and then the Mefat has to pay the Knas. But he at 79, how do we know that she herself could block the Knas? I'm sorry, that she herself could block the marriage. Talmud Lomar, Yimma'ein Mikol Makom, meaning the double language is a ribui to include the Nara in this case. Now again, if we're going with Rashi Shita, everything is pretty smooth, because the discussion here is about marriage. According to Tosvis, then we have to open up the Pasuk here. Let me just read the Pasuk. Yimma'ein, Yimma'ein Avil Laseisa Lo is Kesev Yishkol Kemoa Havsulos. So now we're learning that this is the case of the Knas, and the Ma'en Yima'en gives a ribui for the Isha and adds another veto power that's going to force him to pay the Knas. In other words, on the one end, the Pasuk is talking about marriage, and it says Ma'en Yima'en Avia Laseisa. And the way Tosfos is reading that, that's exclusively the father. He's the one who could be Mima'en Yima'en La Seisa, meaning as far as marriage is concerned, to give her hand to him in marriage. But the rest of the Pasuk is referring to the extra word Yima'en, namely to the Nara, and then it says that Im Yima'en HaNara, right, if I read it that way now, because I have the extra word, is then Kesef Yishkol B'Kemar Absulos. Then he has to pay the knas, regardless of whether the father agrees to marry her off. That's the way Tosfos learns it. So the Gemara says the following. We understand Mefuta, that the father is given the right to veto the marriage, and that's explicit in the pasuk. Elaonis, but wait a second, the Braisa gave the father veto power not only in the case of Mefata, but even in the case of Onis. You remember we had a little bit of a problem with that, because the Torah says Velo Sili Isha, which means that God is, so to speak, in favor of this marriage. So you might ask, well, how does she have the right to veto the marriage in the case of Onis? And that I understand very well. Why? He says, Ksiv. It says in the case of Onis, velo sihiye le'isha. The emphasis here is in the word sihiye. Sihiye is always a lashon havaya, meaning marriage. And the Gemara understands that sihiye le'isha is midaita, meaning she has to approve the marriage. Elavia minolan. But how do we know that the father could be ma'akev, and he can veto the marriage? After all, the Torah says, "Velo seal isha," which means that he has to marry her. So if there's an obligation incumbent upon the ones to marry her, from Vanna Weisman, how do we know that a father has the right to veto such a thing? Now there's a little Tosus here, Divrei Maskil Ella, and he says the following. We have a Gzeirah Shava between Mefata and Ma'anis, and we derive two things going in two directions. It's a two-way street. For example, through this Gzeirah Shava, we're going to find out that in the case of Mefata, the Knas is 50. Because the Torah doesn't mention 50 in the parasha of Mefata. On the other hand, 50 what? What's the Matbea? So there the Torah in Mefata says Shkolet, because Kesev Yishkol. In the case of Ma'anis, it says 50, but it doesn't say what the Matbea is, and that we're going to derive through this Gzeirah Shava. Why not apply this same Gzeirah Shava to the issue of who has veto power in the marriage? And say that just like in the case of Mefata, we understood that both he, the father, and she, the daughter, have veto power, then so too, in the case of Ma'anis, both he and she should have, meaning even the father, should have a veto power.
Okay.
So Tosus answers that there are two different dinim here. The Gzeirah Shava is as far as Knas is concerned. Has nothing to do with marriage. As far as the marriage coming out, then we have to look logically at Onus b'fnei atzmo and Mefata b'fnei atzmo. In the case of Mefata, we understand very well that the father could veto the marriage. But in the case of Ma'anis, where the Torah says v'lo siyah le'isha, we have a very strong argument to believe that the father's out of the picture. And he can't block the mitzvah of v'lo siyah le'isha. In the case of the Isha self in Onus, it says in the Pasuk Tiyah, and Tiyah is Midaita, but how do you know the father's rights to veto? Ah, you'll tell me, well, he had rights to veto in the case of a fata. That Gzeirah Shava is limited to the dinim of Knas. It has no application to the dinim of marriage.
Now, normally in a drash, if we darshan a word, then it's not available for a second drash, normally.
Right.
In a Gzeirah Shava, could theoretically learn a whole bunch of stuff based on the very same Gzeirah Shava?
Sure. In fact, Gzeirah Shava Lemechtza, as a general rule, Gzeirah Shava means everything. You know, equating it
Okay, thank you.
The only difference is that when the parasha is made up of two different parts, you know, one part has to do with knas and that payment, the other part has to do with marriage, then we can separate and decide where the Gzeirah Shava fits in. Now again, keep in mind that the Gemara's Ahavmin here, that the father is out of the picture as far as being as far as veto power in Ones. It's a little bit paradoxical because the father can marry her off to whoever he wants, and now you're telling me that somebody else could marry her off without the father's haskama. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
The paradox is that on the one hand, the father is he is the independent controller, and he's totally in the driver's seat, holding the reins as far as marriage is concerned. He decides whether she does get married, she doesn't get married, who she gets married to and who she doesn't get married to. It's all him. He's the balabas from A to Z. Now you're telling me that the Torah appointed a person, a no good scoundrel by the name of the Ma'anis, that he can marry this girl against the will of the father. That's what the Gemara is saying over here. They're very paradoxical, since the father has total control of a home marriage, and now you're telling me that, forget it, he's out in the cold, the father. You know, he may think that the worst enemy that he has on the face of the earth is this Ma'anis, and he's probably right, and now he becomes his son-in-law. Welcome your son-in-law, you know, invite him to your Shabbos table, you know. And even though you didn't want to marry, and you're the Malabas, I'm marrying her off. It's very paradoxical, this Havamina. But the answer to this is the Pasuk V'lo Siyah Le'isha. And that means the following. Kasha, I'll just read to you the note here. It's in the name of various acronym. He says the following. Hare HaTorah nosna li'av zechus l'kadish es bito. V'einon av yechol l'kadisha shalom yediyoso. There's no one who can marry this girl without his agreement, without his approval. Okay, my duet tzarek pasuk. Why do you need some sort of krav, a svar, or whatever it is, to establish that the father has veto power? No one can marry this girl without his approval. So why doesn't he have veto power? Yeah, because she was raped, that removes the father's zechus to marry off his a daughter? Very, very difficult. So the answer that he offers here, he says, Shema Hayatzad Lomar, what was the Havamina of the Gemara? She came in Sha'omra Torah, V'lo Siyah Le'isha. Ein biyad ha'av limchos. Wow. Philosi Elisha, ein biyad ha'av limchos. I guess the only way to formulate this is that limchot, right? Limchot. Ein biyad ha'av limchot. You know, he can't object. That was the Havamina. And on this Havamina, we're going to have machlokas between Abai and Rava. And frankly speaking, I still don't have exactly what they're arguing about. Let's see. Omar Abai. Abai says, Shaloye Chote Niska. For sure the father could object. Why? Because you're going to tell me that because this Shlob did a Maisa Vera, a terrible, despicable act of onus, therefore he knocks the father out of the picture, and the father no longer has rights to marry a Rav. So basically, Abai is operating with smart. Rav Amar Kalvachomer. Kalvachomer is not necessarily Svara, by the way. Kalvachomer works within certain mechanics of its own. And this Kalvachomer is going to certainly teach me that the father has veto power. Why? Because if the father has veto power in the case of Mefata, and that we saw explicit in the Torah in Mefata, which says in Mo'ein, Yimo'ein, etc., then how much more so should he have veto power in the case of Onis? In other words, his dastardly action, his terrible thing of Mefata, was not so terrible. In other words, it wasn't a rape, so to speak, of her das, it was a rape of the father's das. You know, this wasn't what the father wanted to happen. But it pales compared to the Ma'anis situation. And yet, Bein Hiu, Bein Avi, Yechon Liakev, the Torah gave the father rights to be Ma'akev, the marriage, in the case of Mefata. Is ones, which is so much more severe of a violation. Shavar al das avia vial das atzma. It's a double whammy. You know, forget about das atzma, but it's even das avia. I'm sorry, that didn't make sense. What I just said. No, it's in the first case of a fat, it was an ones al das avia. But in the case of ones, that was mafata. But in case of ones. It's even onis al das atzma. You know, even she didn't agree to it. At least, Chach, in the case of a fata, she consented. It's lo koshkin. How much more so should the father be allowed to be ma'akev this marriage? Why? Because if the Torah says that something terrible happened to this woman, and therefore we have rights. The Torah gives us rights to block the marriage. Then from that perspective, which is more of a terrible action, mafat or onus? Clearly onus, because that violates even das atzma. If the Torah gives the father the rights to block the marriage in the case of mafata, then how much more so in the case of onus? Now again, you and I could argue the other way around. Maybe we could say the following, that in the case of mafata, the father has rights to be ma'akiv, like in general marriage. You know, she's a katana, she's a nara, the father's the balabos of marriage. Why should that change in the case of a fata? But there was a havmin in the case of onis that the father's out of the picture because the Torah commands a mitzvah velosi elisha. So you're going to tell me that it's very paradoxical because the onis is a worse avera. Okay, that's Abai's logic. Abai says we can't allow him to usurp this woman against the will of the father because he did an onis. We're going to reward him with the option or the authority or the power to marry her against the will of the father and rip the father out of his heart. That's Abaye. But Rav is talking about a Kalvachomer, and it's a very strange Kalvachomer. I understand very well in the case of Mefata that the father has rights to block the marriage. The father always has rights to block the marriage. Why should he lose so in the case of Mefata? But the Havmina notice that this is a very unique situation, and the father has no rights to block the marriage. And why is that? Because the Torah says v'lo si elisha. So how do you make a Kalvachomer that certainly in the case of onus the father has the right to veto the marriage? Rav lo amar k'Abaye, kev hadikom shalem lav chotei niskarhu. If you're worried about the fact that he might be motivated to do this action, because look, the payoff is a great payoff. You know, he's going to have to marry this woman despite the father's objection. So Rava says that we can't give a guy a reward for an avera and reward him with the ability to take this girl and run with her, to elope with her. That was Abaye. So Rava says, I can't accept that. Why? Because from Abai's logical perspective, and this is Rava's counter argument, you know what? This is a very attractive situation. You know, I'm going to get rewarded as a result of my marriage, of my onus. Yes, I did an avera, a chet, and now you're rewarding me. That's intolerable. That's Abai's logic. Says Rava, I can tolerate that. Why? Because the Torah already inhibited him. The Torah already put a natural blockage that should inhibit him from doing this mice onus. And what's that?
Knas.
That's the way the Torah was thinking. Now, if in any event this man is, you know, he, despite the fact that he understands very well that it's not worth it financially, but nevertheless, whatever reason he does it, he does the action that he does, and the Torah says Velosi Elisha, so I don't have the svar of Chote Niska. In other words, Abai is looking at Chote Niska from one perspective, a very limited perspective. Rava is saying, well, let's take all the factors into the balance, into the equation. And in the balance, it's not a niska. In other words, if you weigh the pluses and the minuses, number one, the fact that he gains the option of marrying her against the will of the father, but weigh that up against the heavy penalty he's going to pay for this, then we have enough of a deterrent, and it's not a chote niska situation. So Rav is looking at chote niska from the perspective of deterrent. You know, if crime pays, what deters the person, inhibits him from doing the crime, right? That's Rav's perspective. Well, we've already inhibited him from doing the crime, and this albatross over his neck, this payment of knas should be enough of a discouragement to prevent him and inhibit him from doing the action. And that's what we want to accomplish. We don't want it to be a chote niskar where crime pays. Well, crime doesn't pay unless you pay. And here you're going to have to pay a very stiff penalty. Abaye lo amar kerova mefata de'iu motzi mi'akiv avionami motzi mi'akiv. In the case of a fata, the Torah says that he's not obligated to marry her. If he, the mefata, decides, I don't want to take take advantage of this possibility, even though it's very attractive, because if I marry her, I don't have to pay the knas. But in any event, the Torah says, you make that decision. Oh, if the Torah is already giving out veto powers, you know, carte blanche, and everybody pick up their veto power, then I understand in mefata that the father has rights to veto this marriage. I mean, if the husband, you know, the mefata himself, who's a no good scoundrel, if he has rights to decide not to marry her, then the father certainly should have his old tried and true rights to block the marriage. But in the case of ones, the iu lo matzu miyake, where the Torah absolutely, unconditionally requires and obligates the ma'anis to marry this woman, you see that the Torah is really, really hyped up and excited about this marriage, is how do we know that avia, that the father's granted the rights? Again, in mefata, I understand he has these rights to block the marriage. In fact, even the mefata has the right to decide not to marry. The Torah nowhere indicates that this marriage has to go on. That, you know, we should call the Godel Hador to be Mesadar Kiddushin. You know, this, wow, we're excited that in the case of mefata, this marriage has to happen. So it makes sense that the father should retain his rights to block the marriage. After all, she's a Nara. But in the case of Ones, where there's no choice, the Ma'anis is forced to marry her, and that's Velosi Elisha, maybe in such a case, the father doesn't have rights to be Ma'ake. And bottom line is, we don't have a Kal V'chomer. Okay. Now, the next piece of Gemara, which we'll do in Mirtz Hashem on Yom Rishon, is going to analyze the case of ksuba, meaning once a person has to pay a knas, let's say for example in the case of ones, right? Even though he's married her, he pays a knas, which is a very heavy amount of money. Should we also impose upon him the old tried and true obligation, monetary obligation of paying for the ksuba? Now, ksuba is only paid conditionally if he divorces or if he dies. But would the enterprise or the enactment of ksuba apply? Would the chachamim, when they initially enacted this ksuba, would they have imposed it even in the case of ones? Because in the case of ones, he's already paying a knas. Not only that, he can't even divorce her, right? Lo yuchal shalcha. So the whole institution of ksuva is supposed to inhibit a divorce, you know, to prevent it from, you know, you better think twice before you divorce your wife, because you're going to be paying a heavy ksuva, masayim zuz, if it's her first marriage. But why do they have to inhibit a person from divorcing his wife if he's not allowed to divorce his wife? I mean, the inhibition is built into the law. So that's what Gemara is going to vacillate now, whether or not the takonas ksuva should apply in the case of ma'anes, or whether it should. So at this point, I wish everyone a great Shabbos, and we should learn from Pinchas, the great Messias Nefesh of Pinchas, for the sake of his love for Klal Yisrael.